Welcome to the show, folks. I have a guest today who really genuinely changed my life. Think about how often you can say that, and you'll realize what a gift it is to be able to do a show like today's, if you're me. I have remote via Zoom here with me, Dr. Randy Baggison, aka Dr. B. I was introduced to him by a mutual friend. I was growing very tired of my standard American doctor at the time. She was a wonderful lady, but offered me nothing more than prescriptions when I didn't feel like I needed them or thought that there were other ways to prevent the problems. The prior year, I was pretty heavy and had high LDL cholesterol, and she recommended statins. Instead, I adopted a paleo diet, which led to about 45 pounds of weight loss from one exam to the next. The next year at my checkup, I asked her for an NMR profile, which hopefully we'll talk about here today a little bit, instead of the standard lipid profile. She wasn't sure what it was, had to look it up to make sure she could order it from the lab. And when the results finally did come back in, her write-up said something to the effect of, "Your weight loss is impressive, and clearly the statin prescription worked because my LDL was down but still high by conventional measures. But I'm going to suggest that you up the dosage." And immediately I called Dr. Baggison because I thought my other results, such as particle count, HDL, particle size, triglycerides, and my inflammatory markers were good, but I didn't really know what they should be. I just felt like with the panel that I had ordered that she should have commented on those as well. I was also put off because I never went on the statin, and here she was taking credit for the improvements that only happened because of my diet. And for the record, she didn't seem to like my dietary changes or my exercise regimen. So Dr. Baggison sent me a book to read after a consultation and explained that conventional medicine gets heart disease very, very wrong. I read the book front to back, and it was exactly what I was looking for. After analyzing my NMR panel against the metrics recommended in this book, I could see that I did not have a real cholesterol problem, but I definitely wanted the full checkup that Dr. Baggison's practice offered. I'll now hand it over to Dr. B for a minute to introduce his practice and why someone like me with high LDL can still be pretty healthy in terms of actual cardiovascular disease.
Well, thanks, John. My name is Randy Baggison. I run something called the Executive Health Group in Richmond, Virginia. I've been doing this for almost 20 years now. I'm a reformed investment banker from Wall Street that went to medical school. And like John, I have an addiction to CrossFit. And I've worked out and tried to keep myself well, and coming up on my 60th birthday, I hope I'm doing the right things myself. And I do see a physician to make sure that I do so. So what we do here, what I would describe what we do is we do precision personalized healthcare. As an investment banker, I remember going to the doctor, waiting 2 hours for a sore throat, and it was just a pain in my butt. So I went to medical school after working in business, found medical school an arcane experience. We don't allocate resources in the way that I think we should in the medical community. We really don't do preventative healthcare in the United States. We have a very expensive sick care system. We're ranked 36th out of 36 industrialized countries for prevention. Primary care doctors get no credit for doing anything, and really our healthcare system is poised to catch people at the bottom of the cliff once they've had an event, not prevent events. So we spend 90% of our healthcare dollars in the last 2 years of life, 30% in the last 3 weeks. It's just a mess. And so when we look at cardiovascular disease, it kills 50% of women and about 65% of men. And I misspoke. It's all vascular disease, heart attacks, strokes. You can have a gut attack where the vessels that supply blood flow to your intestines become clogged or have an embolus. The evaluation of vascular disease is greatly misunderstood. I work in a hospital, and if I went down to the doctor's lounge and asked most of the doctors what causes vascular disease or heart attacks or stroke, they say cholesterol. Well, cholesterol is essential for human life. What causes it is how your body transports that cholesterol through your vascular system. And to understand that, you need to understand how many particles that your liver produces to carry cholesterol through your bloodstream. Cholesterol is a fat. Your bloodstream is a water-based solution. You can't put a fat in a water-based solution, so your liver produces particles that are called lipoproteins. These are protein-covered cholesterol transport particles. And what matters is how many of them you produce to deliver cholesterol from the liver out to peripheral tissues, and how many you produce to recycle cholesterol back to the liver for degradation and recycling. You need to understand that. You need to understand if those particles become stuck in the wall of the arteries. And most people went to high school and learned that their biggest organ was their skin. It's not. It's the endothelium, or intimal lining of the vessels. So the innermost layer of cells in all of your blood vessels. It's called the intima. It's a tennis court's worth of surface area. Blood always wants to clot. So that intima lining is like a Teflon lining to keep your blood flowing smoothly. However, it is porous to these particles that happen to carry cholesterol. In 1870, John, you and I, our average lifespan was 43. Women, about 47. Well, 150 years later, because of the discovery of penicillin, because of the discovery of immunizations for smallpox and measles, industrialized farming, public sanitation, we've doubled our lifespan. So now what we die of is the process, the abnormal deposit of these particles in the vessel wall. Before, we used to die of starvation and infection. We've overcome those. So people at 50 years old are very accustomed to saying to their doctor, well, it's time for my colonoscopy. Well, colon cancer, a devastating disease, kills 5 or 6 people in 100. If you're talking about men, vascular disease kills 65 out of 100. Well, people go through a colonoscopy for colon cancer. What test do they normally go through to evaluate their risk of vascular disease? A cholesterol panel. A cholesterol panel is used to calculate something called the Framingham risk score. Total cholesterol, HDL, LDL, triglycerides, blood pressure, body mass index, fasting blood sugar, and whether you use tobacco. Well, if you take 100 people who have their first heart attack, unfortunately for 50 of them, their first symptom is they fall over dead. If you retrospectively go down to the emergency room to the lucky 50 who made it in alive and look backwards and calculate their Framingham risk score, 88% of the time the day before their heart attack would show that they had a low risk of having a vascular event. So what we're using for the evaluation of vascular disease is completely inaccurate and, in my opinion, deceitful and a big lie. And it's promoted by the medical establishment. And the book I gave you, which I'm going to put a plug in for, it's called Beat the Heart Attack Gene. It's written by Brad Bale and Amy Doneen.
And I'll add a link to that on Amazon to the show notes for today's show for those who read it. That's one of my most gifted books. Anybody who has any health issues or concerns, I send them that book because it's a wonderful read and it's very easy to read, even though it covers some obviously complex topics.
Yep. And I've become a devotee of both Brad and Amy's program, the Bale-Doneen Heart Attack and Stroke Prevention Model. So using that as the backbone of our practice, you know, this practice, everyone has a mission statement. Mine is the right test for the right reason with the right follow-up. So here at this practice, you know, we call ourselves an executive physical program. You know, when it comes to this private medicine, everybody's got kind of a model. And my model is an executive physical. You come in here, you pay us a fee. We put you through a bunch of tests, none of which harm you, none of which expose you to radiation. But we're using carotid intimal medial thickness measurement. It's like a carotid ultrasound. It doesn't hurt. It's reproducible. It uses ultrasound technology and a software system that measures the thickness of the wall of the artery. And if you read the book beat the heart attack gene. You will become an arteriologist, the study of the arterial wall, because that's where the entire cascade of bad events can occur. First, an individual's genetic predisposition on how many particles they make to carry cholesterol, not how much cholesterol. So think of New York City. How many cabs are there? If there's three cabs on Park Avenue, it doesn't matter. If all three cabs have 10 people in them, well, by normal cholesterol measurement, you'd have high cholesterol, but the number of cabs is low. That's what an LDL particle count is. There's another way to measure that. It's called an ApoB, or an apolipoprotein beta receptor. You talked about an NMR panel, a nuclear magnetic resonance panel, which historically was developed by a company, LipoScience, down in Charlotte, as a matter of fact.
Oh, wow.
I think they've been acquired, and now, hell, Quest probably owns them or somebody. But they use this to actually count the number of particles carrying cholesterol. How much cholesterol is in them is irrelevant, because at that intimal border, it really becomes a question of, in that vessel, on that innermost layer of cells, if there's a lot of particles inside the plasma, they're going to produce a diffusion gradient, promoting the translocation of those particles into the vessel wall. If that happens, again, depending on your genetics, your body can inflame the vessel wall in an autoimmune process. If that occurs, that inflammation could lead to tissue damage. So just like if you're looking at my face, if I got a pimple on my face, white blood cells migrate into that area. They release superoxides to kill bacteria. Well, those superoxides and that oxidative stress can kill normal tissue. And so the skin on top of the pimple 2-3 days later dries up and gets hurt and flakes off. Well, that's what can happen to the protective cells of an artery. If that happens, now you've got a wound in the vein, or the artery, excuse me. If you have a wound in that artery, platelet, fibrin, all of the clotting factors can immediately initiate the clotting process. And heart attacks and strokes occur from blood clots. It's an embolic or thrombotic event. It is not a cholesterol plaque that causes it. The plaque can initiate inflammation, but arterial disease and a quick clog of a vessel is caused by a blood clot. So the next question is, what are your clotting genetics? Do you have a mutation called factor V Leiden, prothrombin mutation, protein CNS deficiencies, a methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase gene deficiency, a lipoprotein particle called LP little a? These are all necessary things to evaluate your risk of vascular disease. Now, I've gone off like a bottle rocket.
No, this is perfect. This is great. I think that people are going to love that explanation, because it really gets to the heart of what causes the problem to begin with. It isn't just a bunch of LDL being recycled throughout your body, which is what most of the normal panels are telling you.
Right. So, you know, in my practice, again, the right test for the right reason for the right follow-up. So what scares me as a person? Losing my mind. Mm-hmm. Okay. Dementia. Well, how does dementia occur? Most people go, oh, well, you get Alzheimer's disease. Well, what's Alzheimer's disease? It's an inflammatory cascade in your brain. It's actually kind of like an autoimmune process. Something's pissed your brain off. You start to produce beta amyloid. The beta amyloid can oxidize and turn into tau beta amyloid and tau proteins, which inhibit the pre and postsynaptic junctions and inhibit neurotransmitter transmission, primarily acetylcholine. So the medicines we have are like Namenda. It's an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor. Once you release from a presynaptic junction that neurotransmitter, it quickly fires over to the postsynaptic junction, and it's degraded very quickly. Well, the medicine we have keeps that neurotransmitter pinging. Well, the problem with that, it causes nausea and a lot of side effects, and it's not very effective.
And your answer would be, let's figure out how to prevent this from happening to begin with by attacking the inflammatory the things that
20,
are causing
30,
it.
40 years before that happens. That's right. So again, you know, in our discussion of the business model and the business of private medicine, delivering a really valuable service builds our business here. Well, what's that valuable service? It's true precision preventative healthcare. So I'll bring up cognitive impairment. For me, I worry about that. How do you find that? Well, you look for inflammation. Mm-hmm. You look for genetic predispositions that could increase your risk of these processes happening. What's the next thing I worry about? Probably a stroke. Because a stroke, if you or I have one and we survive it, you can be extremely debilitated by that process. I'm going to say something that might seem counterintuitive. If I have a big heart attack and fall over, I'm gone. You know, do I care? Well, sure I do. I don't want to miss my family and, mm-hmm. and the people who rely on me. But then you think about things that people worry about, and then there comes cancer, of course. Well, in 2019, I believe that we understand a lot about the processes that can lead to cognitive decline, that can lead to having a stroke or heart attack. Those are things that with precision healthcare, we can prevent. Cancer is the process of early detection. I'm going to turn this now into how we run our business. Okay. Well, for me, as a informed healthcare consumer, which most people are not, and I encourage them to become one, what do you want from your private medical group, your concierge physician, your executive health program, your DPC, direct patient care practice? So I'm kind of dissecting now the business models. Most concierge doctors are, I have my cell phone here. What I don't have is my stethoscope. Well, that's what most of them are. They're selling access. And a lot of concierge doctors, you walk up and say, hi, I want to do a genomic gut bacteria test. And they go, what the hell's that? Or I want to do a preventative cardiometabolic panel. Well, what's that?
I think these are all things that I've asked you, Dr.
Well, that's right. So a lot of doctors sell access. Hey, you can get me. You got a sore throat, I'll call you in a Z-Pak. And that's a very valuable service. Don't get me wrong. Then there are places like the Mayo Clinic that do executive physicals. Well, frankly, I have wealthy individuals at my practice who see me here in Richmond, Virginia, who also have homes in Florida, who also have resources enough that they also go down to the Mayo Clinic. Now, I can tell you, I got to be careful here because I don't want to besmirch the name of the Mayo Clinic. I get those reports back. Guess what they get done for cardiovascular test? A lipid panel. Total cholesterol, LDL, HDL, triglycerides.
Wow.
No inflammatory markers, no advanced genetics. And I'm like, what, you know, the Mayo, you have a tertiary or quaternary medical problem. They are an expert sick care provider. I would argue that they are not at the vanguard of prevention. And I believe that this practice and what we do here and what I strive every day to continue to learn about is the vanguard of preventative healthcare. So we here charge a fee for an executive physical. We give our patients all access for the following year. In doing so, again, from a business standpoint, because I think you wanted to talk a little and chat a little about that,
absolutely.
Our fee is acceptable by the IRS for flex spending account, health savings account. Whereas if you join a membership medical practice, that is not the case. You can't pay for a membership using IRS deductible funds. There are other medical practices called DPC, direct patient care. And that's a typical primary care office that's not frequently doing advanced preventative precision medicine, but they'll see you for $50 at the moment's notice, and you just go in, you don't use insurance, they'll give you a super bill, you can send that to your insurance company if you want to or not. There's all kinds of telemedicine programs that are that are you know, becoming more and more popular for people who want to just pick up their phone, who got a sore throat, and say, hey, I don't have a concierge doctor. I don't have a membership into a executive health program, but I can get a doctor, DrOnCall.com. And just like we're looking at each other, you know, have a health experience and get some help.
Well, I take it for some kind of acute but minor problems, that's probably a very suitable solution. Obviously, preventing cardiovascular disease is a marathon and not a sprint. And
yes, that's correct. That's doing one push-up and as opposed to working out for a year. That I would agree with that. But again, I think it has a place and it's a value and. If it will prevent someone from getting more ill and showing up in an ER when something could have been done very simply and they don't have access to something else, I think it's a great thing. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great. And so you've laid out a bunch of related business models, but yours is the executive health model that's focused on the executive physical and then kind of layers in some characteristics of the others throughout the year on the back of doing that executive physical every year.
That's correct. And I don't, you know, I've been a member of something called the American Academy of Private Physicians. I think our model is rather unique. Not many people do it this way. When I started this practice, frankly, I came actually from another concierge practice with a non-compete for membership medical care. So of course, being the smart businessman I am, I went out and started an executive health program and did executive physicals immediately. And frankly, for me, that was another part of building this business. To me, it's much easier to go to Johnson & Johnson, walk in the boardroom, appeal to the executives who are as valuable a resource to that organization as property, plant, trucks, and equipment, and do the preventative maintenance on employees and key employees and sell it en masse and get 50 patients, then talk to 1,000 Mrs. Johnsons to get 50 patients. So from the marketing standpoint, from my background as an institutional fixed income salesman, very used to promoting myself to, you know, elegant high-end organizations, you know, that was a natural fit for me to walk into the boardrooms of the Fortune 1000 companies here in my hometown. And that's served us well.
Excellent. Yeah, it's got to be cheaper than the key man insurance that they're buying these executives, right?
You know, they're preparing for death. They're not preparing for life. And I'll give another plug to a book that's written by a friend of mine, Joel Kahn, who I met at the Cleveland Heart Lab. He wrote a book called Dead Executives Don't Get a Bonus. I think he should have. Yeah. It should have been Dead Executives Don't Get to Spend Their Bonus. They get their bonus. Their significant other gets it. And it's a little lighter read, and I think a very, very good a work that I like to give my busy business executives who frequently, you know, put themselves and their healthcare and their wellness, you know, well down the priority list of their lives.
Well, and I was talking to, I advise a lot of younger entrepreneurs who are just getting started or maybe have raised their first round of funding. And just because of my background, they reach out to me. And I was telling someone today, a very young guy, he's like, well, how do you get a balance? And I'm like, you have to commit to anything that you want to balance and you have to put that first. And I said, health is the number one thing probably after your family that you have to do in order to be successful. And it isn't just about not dying, but the quality of life. I told him, if you're stressed out all the time and your mind's racing and you feel like crap and you're 40 pounds overweight and you're breathing heavy when you walk up a flight of stairs and you're sweating profusely every time you put a suit on, you're not going to be effective at being a business person. So you better commit first to eating correctly, exercising correctly, managing stress, managing kind of balancing life. So I think that's a really, really important point. And obviously the most obvious is you need to be alive to be in the game. But
Couldn't agree more.
Wow. So you covered a lot of ground there. I want to dig into both the business and also into some of the details just around some of this. I want to kind of nerd out with you on a couple of things that I think there's some confusion out there in the medical world. So you mentioned a little bit, you mentioned that the conventional approach will try to lower cholesterol kind of at any cost, but cholesterol is a very important thing to have. So it sounds like the conventional approach is worse than ineffective. It can have awful effects on testosterone. I'm assuming that that's one of the things you're talking about that's essential, you know, that you need cholesterol in there. And maybe it ignores true lurking problems. Can you just comment on some of the downsides to just rampantly lowering cholesterol at all costs?
Well, first, cholesterol is a normal, natural substance. And, you know, when people say, well, cholesterol is bad, well, is protein bad? You know, is bone bad? The answer is no. So cholesterol and dihydroepiandrosterone sulfate are two very important pre-hormones.
Is that and, DHEA?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yep, DHEAS. And those are the two major, and they're interrelated and your body, you know, goes back and forth between them. But think of a funnel. And in the funnel, we're talking about something called steroidogenesis, which for every med student causes them to quake. And frankly, if I reach under my blotter on my desk, which I can do as we speak, I actually have the steroidogenesis pathway right here. Because I have to refer to it, because I can't remember it all the time. But think of a cascade of manufacture. Cholesterol starts in a process. We all, when you just talked about stress, well, what's the first hormone that our bodies make? I'll tell you what it is. Cortisol. It's the stress hormone. And if we're constantly under stress, we're pumping out cortisol like crazy. And cortisol, when it was designed for us, I don't know if it's 500,000 years ago, who did it? I'm not saying it's the aliens, God, or Darwin, who cares? The point is, it's a stress hormone, and it's there if the saber-toothed tiger is running at us, we release it, it pumps up our sugar, it produces a response in our muscles and our whole body systems to deal with stress. The problem is, as I held up my cell phone before, when this thing buzzes, I'm making cortisol, mm-hmm. and so is everybody else. So our world is different. When cortisol
is up, if correct me if I'm wrong, but it shuts off your digestive system, your reproductive system, other systems, you need to get away from that saber-toothed tiger.
It's called cortisol steel. Okay. That's correct. You're going to make cortisol, not mineralocorticoids, sex hormones like testosterone and estradiol. So these chemicals in our body, these naturally occurring substances, are there. Our world has changed how our body reacts. Stress changes how we make hormones. So the steroid pathways, and steroids are mineralocorticoids, glucocorticoids, which affect our blood sugar, mineralocorticoids, which affect our blood pressure, and sex hormones. Your brain. What's your brain made of? Cholesterol. So you said, you know, when we drop cholesterol drastically, you know, the method that we use for that are statins. Statins are something called HMG-CoA reductase inhibitors. That's the enzyme that's inhibited by a statin. Statins, in my opinion, are very useful medications. Statins will lower cholesterol production, which in turn can affect cholesterol particle count. Statins are also probably anti-inflammatory. Mm-hmm. Okay. And they're useful medications. What people don't understand is that measuring cholesterol is arcane. What they should be measuring is particle count, inflammation. Mm-hmm. Cholesterol's, again, a huge part of our brain. I'm going to guess and say that 40% of the brain is made up of cholesterol and lipids and we start to affect it. I mean, that's why some of the medications like Lipitor have nicknames like Stupitor. And medications that can lower cholesterol can also affect muscle respiration and things in the muscle like a methionine pump, which gets rid of the byproducts of muscle metabolism. And that's why some of those medications can cause myopathy and aches and pains. You know, frequently we're given these medications to 40 to 50 to 60 year old people who, when they walk up a flight of stairs, their muscles get sore anyway. But what else can change cholesterol? Obviously, aerobic exercise, dietary choices. Okay. We could launch into a whole thing. If I had my computer that you could see, I could pull up from the map of the United States and look at obesity trends from 1985 to today. Obesity is an epidemic. Why is it an epidemic? Because of the promotion of highly processed foods, primarily carbohydrates. Well, who runs the U.S. Department of Agriculture? Probably retired executives from ConAgra and ADM. And what are they promoting? Corn, soybean, wheat, gluten-containing things. Right. So, you know, you mentioned you're on a paleo diet. Mm-hmm. You know, I always use the term, you know, when people ask me, send me to a nutritionist. Well, who do I want to send them to? I want them to talk to me because I want them to eat frequently. I want them to eat a small amount. Again, I don't know how long humans have been on the earth. Half a million, a million years. You're a software executive. We have a software system. When was it built? It was built a half a million years ago. Mm-hmm. What did we do a half a million years ago? We walked around picking up high fiber sticks, twigs, and stuff, eating bugs, occasionally some protein, but primarily very low glycemic index foods. Mm-hmm. And we ate a little bit of it all the time. So we were always starving. So we were starving to death. So if we found a fruit tree, we walked up, ate as much fruit as we could. What does fruit do? It's a high glycemic food. It raises your insulin level. Well, insulin is a pro-inflammatory mediator. Insulin is an appetite stimulant. Insulin makes you tired. So you ate a bunch of fruit, you fell asleep. You woke up 3 hours later after your body said, oh, make a bunch of fat cells. Well, again, you're starving, you're skinny. So you wake up and you're hungry again. You eat as much fruit as you can again, you fall asleep. Mm-hmm. Okay. And until the saber-toothed tiger chases you away from that fruit tree, so maybe you gained a little bit of very important fat because you might not eat for a week now. Well, a pound of fat has about 3,200 calories. To run a marathon takes 3,600 calories.
Wow.
Okay, so you know, fat is a great way to store energy. And our software system built a half a million years ago when we were starving to death was perfect. Fast forward to today. You know, here in my town, if I go over to a good Italian restaurant and I order I order ziti with, you know, with carbonara, whatever, I get a trash can lid full of pasta. It's probably 6,000 or 7,000 calories. And that's what we eat. And we eat once or twice a day, these huge meals. So our software system says, oh, you must be starving. Let's release a bunch of insulin. Let's make fat cells and let's make you tired and let's raise your inflammation. It's not such a great thing to do. So the paleo diet, the Mediterranean style of eating, all that means is eating high quality protein and fat. Fat is not bad, the right fats, okay? You know, olives, tree nuts, again, the right fats, not saturated fats, not animal fats. Sorry to the paleo diet with eating as much bacon as you want. A lot of vegetables, low glycemic foods. You didn't hear me say fruit. I'm a promoter of dark berries with the polyphenols and the antioxidants and the wonderful minerals and everything else that they have. But fruit is not always just a pass. So Sure. Those things will lower inflammation, and that type of eating will also enhance your cholesterol transport. So
that's great. So would you say that inflammation is the number one enemy when it comes to fighting cardiovascular disease?
It's certainly one of them. We all have our inherent genetic traits on how we manufacture particles to collect cholesterol. Then how does our body react to those particles being in the wall of the artery? Because we're living longer. Again, 500 years ago, if we're living till 30, how many heart attacks, how much cancer was there? Not that much. You died, you know, you got a cut on your leg and you pussed out and you died.
Yeah.
Or you died of starvation. Now we're living longer. These particles get in the wall. Inflammation. What causes it? Well, frequently, if you think about where your immune system lies, where's most of it? From your mouth to your other end, right. Your gut. 70-80% of your immune system there. We talked about food. What's promoted now? Cheetos, potato chips, okay? Pasta.
Not a lot of fiber.
Not a lot of fiber. Mm-hmm. Plenty of something called lectins. The primary lectin that most people relate to is gluten. These are things produced by plants as self-defense mechanisms. Years ago, if we ate them and we got a bellyache, we didn't eat it again. But all these lectins are in our food system. Again, primarily gluten. We didn't really have a lot of dairy in our food system either. So when we eat things, it can inflame our gut. And our gut should have nice, tight junctions between what are called the enterocytes. So just like I talked about the intima layer of cells in your arterial and vascular system, your gut has an intricate layer of cells called the enterocytes. And their job is to figure out whether there is something in your alimentary canal, again, the tube between your mouth to the other end, that is either a nutrient or an invader. And their job is to propel invaders and to absorb nutrients. If you're constantly bombarding your gut with foods that irritate it, the junctions between these enterocytes can loosen. This is called impaired intestinal permeability or leaky gut. Again, many in traditional medicine do not accept this process. But what's below these enterocytes? Something called the GALT, gut-associated lymphoid tissue. That's 70-80% of your immune system. Now, if your gut has impaired intestinal permeability and it's letting large macromolecules of actually good nutritious foods down to the immune complex, where your body says, I don't know what this is, let's make an antibody against it, suddenly you're producing all these antibodies. Those are likely the antibodies that are going up into your brain and causing some autoimmune attack of normal neural tissue. When should we identify this? 50 years before your grandmother got Alzheimer's disease. So understanding inflammatory cascades and inflammation, asthma is an inflammatory disease, Crohn's disease, periodontal disease in your teeth, psoriasis, mm-hmm. inflammatory arthritis. All of these, you know, pelvic inflammatory disease, you just name it, any kind of
initial bacterial overgrowth. Is that another one?
SIBO. That's correct. So again, the way over prescription of antibiotics. Mm-hmm. Okay. Think of our food system. Every piece of protein that most people eat has antibiotics and growth factor in it. Okay. 95% of carbohydrates produced in this country have glycophosphates on them. Roundup. Mm-hmm. These are all things that can add to the toxic milieu, to the inflammatory milieu of disease. You know, people may recognize the name Dale Bresden. He's the father, you know, he's the author of the book, The End of Alzheimer's. Great scientist. He has a theory on Alzheimer's disease. And the theory relies on, number one, an inflammatory process, Number two, the lack of trophic support. So the loss of estradiol in women, the loss of testosterone in men, the loss of brain-derived neutrophilic factor, also a cascade of toxicity. You know, we're all walking around and cars are driving around and there's more mercury. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, from plastic water bottles. You know, there's an onslaught of real toxicity. That hasn't even begun. I haven't even thought of, you know, again, including the food system where, you know, every piece of poultry, most fish, beef, pork, all of it is getting, you know, the average length of time to grow a calf to a butchered steer used to be about 2 years. It's now like 8 months.
Wow.
Because of growth factors and antibiotics that all these things are being exposed to in industrialized farming. You know, that goes to industrialized farming. You know, we used to have all these little 100-acre farms. Not anymore. Every farm's 100,000 acres, and there's a John Deere tractor being driven by AI to maximize crop yield. So, you know, we've lost a lot of the diversity in our food system. So,
oh yeah, absolutely. Well, it sounds like you'd say that the number one prescription then for fighting off inflammation, chronic inflammation, because again, I think you made it pretty clear, some inflammation is good and necessary, but the chronic inflammation that we face in our modern lifestyles, it sounds like it certainly is fixing the diet to the extent that you can. I'd like to talk about some other things that maybe have some impact on that. And maybe if you could just rank them at a high level in terms of their effect on health, or maybe just speak to them. So you mentioned diet. You talked a little bit about exercise. That I'd like for you to comment on that one as well. Meditation or mindfulness or just some way of controlling stress. Supplements for maybe when your food supply is so overfarmed that you just can't get the nutrients that you normally get. Proper amounts of sleep. Exposure to sunlight. I think that there's also some, you know, artificial light issues that we have that I've read about that maybe impact overall health as well. Can you talk about maybe how you think about those? And I can repeat any of them if you didn't catch them.
Well, certainly exercise. I'll try to go down your list and please prompt me for that. Mm-hmm. You know, exercise is going to release all kinds of wonderful neurohormones, endorphin release. Exercise is going to promote certain inflammatory processes that promote apoptosis, mm-hmm. that kind of help clean ourselves of decaying cellular matter, mm-hmm. and promote regeneration of more viable cells. It can promote the expression of telomerase, which is the enzyme that helps repair our DNA. At the end of all of our chromosomes, or the tips of them, is where they decay. It's called the telomeres. There are certain organisms like lobsters and sea urchins that their repair systems are always on. And unless they get eaten by one of us, they can live forever, where our telomerase is off. But there are certain things that promote the transcription and activation of telomerase in our bodies.
And before you continue, just remind me, I want to talk a little bit about if you've done any research into it, but I've been reading a lot about NAD plus and NR and their effect on those telomere lengths. So don't have to comment on that yet, but I do want to come back to that if you'd like to talk about that.
Well, right now, you know, those are things that again activate telomerase activity and promote the repair of our DNA. You know, as we age, and we're doing this conversation on the dawn of D-Day, I was actually watching TV last night. They were talking about the effects of radiation on the bombs that were dropped in Japan, unfortunately. And what bothered those people and what radiation does, and we're all affected by radiation when we go out in the sun, is that affects our DNA. So we can just get these things called single nucleotide damage. We can see the ends of our chromosomes start to decay. And most of the supplements that you just mentioned have impact on DNA integrity and repair. And again, telomerase is the major one there. And NAD and some other things, I think Elysium and some other high-end.
Maybe resveratrol has some impacts there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes. So all of those things are trying to maintain the integrity of the DNA backbone that keeps us alive and all of our proteins, that's the blueprint for all of our proteins that we make. So exercise, you know, diet, you know, there are definitely pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory diets. How you define that at this point, again, I think the protocol we follow here is to identify in a patient, number one, based on symptomatology or their desire. You know, there's an old TV show. It's gonna go. I can't remember the name of it, but they did a song parody on Chick the Poo, and it's looking for the signs by measuring zonulin, calprotectin, secretory IgA, other signs of gut inflammation. It's also doing an analysis of the bacteria in your gut, looking for what we call dysbiosis. You know, your 10 trillion cells, you have 40 trillion bacteria in your body. Those bacteria are releasing neurohormones and things that affect our behavior. You feed those bacteria carbohydrates, they go, ooh, I like sugar. I'm going to release neurohormones to say, I'm hungry, eat more sugar. So if you have those bacteria in your gut because you're feeding them with sugar, they're going to promote consumption of sugar.
That's interesting because I've heard people say that your gut is your other brain, and sometimes it even overrides your brain. And I guess that's what you're talking about right now is exactly that concept.
Well, you have more nerves in your enteric nervous system than you do in your central nervous system, but you also have lots of neurohormones from the bacteria in your gut. So there are kind of, it's two against one, frankly. And yes, your gut can override your brain plenty of times. So analysis of gut inflammation, gut bacteria. If you find that you have impaired intestinal permeability, you need to heal your gut. Well, how do we heal your gut? With things like chondroitin sulfate, omega-3s, glutamine, L-glycine. There are all kinds of probiotics. We need to look for abnormal parasitology, intestinal overgrowth with yeast. Mm-hmm. There are natural things that you can take, oregano, berberine, that can help moderate the overgrowth of some of these things. There are all kinds of pro and prebiotics that
Does collagen take. Help in that? I've heard that collagen is very healthy for your gut and bone.
Absolutely.
Those type of things. Okay. Well,
and that's where chondroitin and chondroitin sulfate, things high in chondroitin, come from. So yes, bone broth is one of the things that helps. If we define that your gut is healthy, the next thing to look at from an inflammatory standpoint is, do you have food sensitivities? Now here, this is a topic that I could talk for an hour on, but quickly, allergic response in humans. People think of, okay, that kid is allergic to peanuts. That's an IgE antibody mediated allergic response. You touch peanuts, their lips blow up, their airway shuts down, they die. There are various immunoglobulins in our bodies. So you can have an IgG, that's the traditional medicine definition of allergy. And then you can have a sensitivity. That's an IgG antibody moderated immune response. Food sensitivity is usually measured using IgG. Mm-hmm. This is, again, a controversial topic in traditional gastroenterology practice. You know, there's no such thing as leaky gut. There's no such thing as food allergy. Well, you know, and I don't mean to make statements. There are very progressive doctors. There are very conservative doctors. I think this is a real thing. There's no doubt in my mind there's a real thing. So testing for food sensitivity. And that can vary. If someone goes overboard and they're only eating, you know, venison and that's all they eat, you know, sometimes your gut can get a little fatigued on that. You test, and suddenly that shows up. Well, if you eliminate it from the diet, you can usually fix that. You know, this is a simple thing to demonstrate. You know, if a pet owner brings their dog to the vet, and the pet's itching all the time, it's throwing up mucusy junk, it's, you know, having diarrhea and mucusy stools, its fur is falling out, almost every vet will look at that pet owner and go, okay, lamb and rice, feed it that for 3 months, bring it back. They bring the dog back. It's looking great. Yeah. It's cured. When patients come to me and say, you know, my hair's falling out, I have brain fog, my energy sucks, I don't sleep well, my nose is congested, I'm always, you know, I'm getting intestinal bloating, I got constipation, diarrhea, and I look at them and go, lamb and rice, they say, forget it, it never happens. So understanding...
They want a pill instead, they want a pill.
Yeah, well, that's right. Can I have some Nexium and I'm all better? That's correct. So you can do food allergy testing. And, you know, here in Richmond, we got a great organization called Salveo Diagnostics, and it's a great lab that does this, and we use them all the time. So
that's excellent.
So that's food.
Yeah.
So you asked about supplements. So that's a topic that I love. 5 years ago, I got to admit it. People would walk in here and they got a bag of supplements, and I'd go, "Where'd you get those?" Oh, I went to my naturopathic doctor and they told me that this will make me feel better. And I went, okay, why? Now, recently we've started to use a genomic test. And this genomic test uses a artificial intelligence to do your full analysis of all of the things called single nucleotide polymorphisms.
SNPs.
SNPs.
Okay.
So it's a SNP test, and people can argue whether SNP tests are good or bad, or full human genomics are good or bad. This SNP test uses the known SNPs that provide biochemical enzymatic reaction definition in, like, you, an individual. Mm-hmm. So it does that. It then takes that information and does an artificial intelligent literature search, categorizing the validity of that literature, and then uses that information to promote specific nutrigenomic therapy for that individual. Personalized precision supplementation. And I'll use myself as an example. So I have a SNP. It's called a catecholaminophiltransferase. Mm-hmm. It's the enzyme that degrades epinephrine and norepinephrine, the hormones that when you're in a stressful situation and you release them. So they're the fight or flight.
Okay.
You got it. So in the typical individual, you chew through epinephrine and norepinephrine in 3-4 minutes. Well, my enzyme's got about an 80% blockade. So for me, it hangs around for 20, 25 minutes. Well, by definition, this SNP, if you have it, raises your cardiovascular disease risk because you can take a place and cause vasoconstriction mm-hmm. in an artery, and it can raise your risk of having a heart attack or stroke. So I, knowing this, can take a supplement. It's actually ashwagandha.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Yeah,
ashwagandha that can do a leapfrog over that impaired enzymatic bottleneck and open up and restore my enzymatic degradation of norepinephrine and epinephrine to about 80% of normal.
Wow.
I have another one that because of the way you metabolize beta amyloid, again, you can make too much beta amyloid in your brain from an inflammatory thing, but you also might have an impaired degradation enzymatic pathway in your brain. I do. Because of that, I can take a supplement that can repair that enzymatic function. So I've been doing this test. I'm one of the beta users. It's called Intellix DNA. To me, it's a fascinating application of personalized genomics and personalized nutrigenomic therapy.
I think that's the future of medicine. That seems like it, and nutrition and everything, right? And I hope I'll sign up as a beta tester number 2 or 3 or 4 for my physical's going to be in August. So I would love to see the results of that.
It's not exactly a cheap test. It's not 23andMe or DNA Fit or you know, Ancestry.com. Because of the artificial intelligence tool behind it. Now, all this genomic sequencing, the cost of it is collapsing, mm-hmm. Which is great. becoming more available. And, you know, again, from the analysis of big data, I think as individuals, we might be worried about privacy, but we also have the benefit of understanding our own enzymatic biochemistry. And by doing so, you know, a lot of patients, I do this test on them and they go, okay, what do you want me to do? And I put together a portfolio of 10 or 12 supplements. And they go, okay, I'm taking these. Now what? And I'm like, what you're doing is saving for your healthcare retirement. You are lowering the baseline level of inflammatory processes in your body. And you may not feel this, but you're doing it at 30 years old. And as medicine evolves and as genomic applications of medicine evolve, I think, as you just said, this is the future of what we're going to do. I actually believe we can decrease the risk of cognitive impairment, vascular disease, muscle wasting, osteoporosis, you name it. And it's the next frontier that will propel, like I said, vaccinations, immunizations, and the discovery of antibiotics gave us a big leap in longevity. Genomic medicine, I think, is one of the next frontiers that will do that as well and make us well longer if, and it's a big if, you are doing the right things. And you know, people pay me all this money and they come in. I did two follow-ups on people today. What did I talk about? Diet and exercise. And they're like, I did all this and you're talking about diet and exercise? And I'm like, they are the cornerstones of how you take care of yourself. And you mentioned sleep, mindfulness. Well, mindfulness, meditation, what is it doing? It's decreasing this cortisol steel hormone pathway. It's calming ourselves. It's lowering the secretion of norepinephrine, adrenaline, cortisol. And by doing so, lowering the inflammatory cascades in our body.
It's interesting because meditation is one that, you know, I track it with an app and it's kind of a guided meditation. And I've now done about 125 in the 3 years that I've been using the app. And it's one I've been tracking lately how often I do it. And I noticed that when I go 4 or 5 days without doing it, I just feel stressed, but it's so hard. It's for whatever reason, it's easy for me to get up and do a CrossFit workout at 5:30 in the morning. It's just easy. And it's also very easy for me to put down the hamburger and eat the paleo diet. Meditation's really hard for me. I don't know why. I think it's just because we're so wired to the lifestyle that we've got right now that we don't think about stopping and stuff. But it's literally 10 minutes. I can take 10 minutes out of my day and completely change the way I'm feeling that day and the stress levels and my productivity. And I know this, but it's still hard. Do you find that it's similarly hard for folks or?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's our way of life. You know, if you look at some of the longevity studies and you look at, you know, some of the cultures in Japan where, you know, they're eating 30, 40% higher fiber diets, they are exercising, they go to work and they're exercising, they go to work and they have meditation class. You know, our society does not value this. We just don't. You know, quick thing, back to the business model. People, remember my background. You know, my brother is an asset manager and runs billions, and all of my clients are constantly looking at their Vanguard account and their 401k. So these are monetary assets. And I frequently, you know, I define myself as an asset manager. The asset is your wellness or your health. I'm a health asset manager. There's another book that I know I've probably given you, you know, Younger Next Year, which I find is a, you know, it's a simple, quick read. And it's a great thing about mindfulness and sleep and connection psychologically, socially, exercise, moderation of alcohol. It's just it's a self-care book. They don't do the greatest job, in my opinion, on cardiovascular wellness in it. Sure. I think they could enhance that if they listen to the
bill. But if I recall correctly, that book, the main thrust of it is just get out and get some exercise every day, right? I mean, it's...
Don't overeat, sleep. Well, one of the things they say in it is, you know, people go to work and people take work very seriously and their job description very seriously. Make health part of that job description. So if you put on your schedule, like we're doing this call right now, mm-hmm. if you had on your schedule 15 minutes mindful meditation, and if you're working alone, you follow it. If you had a staff, then you told the staff to really honor that and in fact instill it for themselves. You know, some of the more fun things I do is interact with, you know, incredibly high functioning business leaders. And the most interesting companies that I serve, they're doing this in their organizations. And I see it. And there are other organizations that absolutely don't do it. And there's a difference in the stress, wellness levels, satisfaction of those different corporate cultures that I have an incredibly unique seat of observation to watch it happen. It's very interesting.
I could see that being very useful in a corporate setting. I do want to get to the business model here in a second, but another question I've got. I've recently become a huge fan of spending time in the sauna. And when you talk about cultural traditions and long-lived societies, I think there have been some studies out there. Is sauna something that you've paid much attention to medically or looked at any of the studies or have any thoughts on?
To say I'm an expert on it would be folly. Mm-hmm. However, do I believe in sauna? Absolutely. You know, how do you rid yourself of toxic chemicals and elements? You sweat them out. You mm-hmm. sweat them out, or we try to chelate them out. So, you know, one of the things I take is N-acetylcysteine, which is a substance that I have my mercury levels sky high because I'm a sushi nut. Okay. So I'm always looking for ways. So exercise, you sweat, sauna, great way. What do you do in the sauna? You go in and you sit and you're mindful and you sweat like crazy and you're pouring toxic chemicals out of your body. There's no doubt that it's a great detox strategy, a great mind quieting strategy.
Excellent.
I hopefully I'm going to charge you more next year and I'll be able to buy an infrared sauna.
That's what I did. I got a far infrared sauna and it's nice because if you get that thing to about 140, I feel like I sweat the way I do 180 in a more traditional sauna, but it's a little more comfortable. Yeah. In fact, my 7-year-old likes to sit in a couple times a week with me and he recently hit 25 minutes and I think it would have been hard for him to sit in a traditional sauna for that long. One of the things I've noticed in your practice is you have a lot of technology that I haven't seen in other doctors' offices. You've got the eyesight goggles that just are fascinating to me because they seem to be very effective in testing eyesight. Or you've got the electrostatic body fat percentage scale, the EKG that you use on the stress test, to the software that overlays mole pictures that you take each year to measure growth of moles for skin cancer reasons, presumably. Talk to the audience about your philosophy on technology and how do you stay on top of the latest and greatest research, and why do most doctors come to such a different conclusion on these investments, do you suppose?
Well, a lot of the things that we do here, people must understand the traditional delivery of medicine and medical care is based on illness. So we have an in-body scale. And that, so when I try to get somebody to lose weight, I want to know if they're losing fat or muscle. Mm-hmm. And all that does is run a small electric current through them. And it's a scale that gives me your percent body fat, muscle mass, fat mass, everything else. That's not, no one will pay a doctor. An insurance company won't reimburse for that process. We do something, we have an ultrasound machine in the office. So we image your carotid arteries because it's a macrovascular evaluation, and it's evaluation of the wall, not the lumen of the artery. So we're looking for arterial wall thickening. Mm-hmm. Again, that study is not reimbursed by typical insurance process. We have a stress lab in our office where we have a treadmill. We do a treadmill stress test with an echocardiogram. And frankly, and openly, it's not the best test to find vascular disease, but it's a great motivator for our patients because they come in, they want to beat their time from last year.
Your nurses ask me, they're like, you've beaten it every year. Yeah. You're a CrossFit guy. Let me guess, do you want me to let you keep going so you can beat it again? I was like, yes.
Yeah, which you don't have to. But so that tells us a lot of information though. Your exercise tolerance, mm-hmm. It looks for conduction abnormalities. So your heart is a machine. It's a pump. It has valves. It has a plumbing system, the coronary arteries, and it has an electrical wiring harness. So that test gives us an insight into all of those things. It doesn't do you any harm. Is it the best way to evaluate your coronary arteries? No, it's not. But doing the carotid ultrasound, we still send people for CT scans of their coronary arteries looking for calcium. We use all kinds of technology. We have a photo finder system. So what that is it's a system that takes a series of 17 digital pictures, and it has, again, a software backbone that can compare this year's image to next year's to look for a new pigmented lesion. It's looking for melanoma. It's not perfect, but it's utilizing technology. It's another check and balance in the process of trying to deliver precision, personalized healthcare. Why don't most doctors do it? Because they're not compensated for it. And, you know, when I started this practice, there was no roadmap. I just, okay, here's my office. I'm going to go sell this. Holy shit. What's going to happen? And you know, through like other entrepreneurs, through perseverance and hard work, here I am 18, 19 years later. And that's not without fits and starts and growth and learning. But the use of laboratory technology, the use of genetic technology, the use of hardware technology and software technology in an application, again, of completely thinking out of the box. Because if you go to med school, nobody teaches you any of this. Zero. Zero. You're not taught this. You know, I hope to bring this practice, and I'll be careful with what I say, to the next level. What is the next level? The next level is highly accurate, full body imaging, the use of full human genomic data, the use of advanced biomarkers, the use of advanced inflammatory markers, and the interpretation of that information using megadata and AI. It's right around the corner. Stay tuned.
So
because I plan to develop the most advanced precision healthcare experience that is available. And I could talk about that for hours, but I'd want to talk about that offline.
Sure. No, and that's why I wanted to have you on the show, because what I do in this podcast is interview folks that I think are defying conventional wisdom. I call it the Defiance Podcast. And I think that you are talking about the future, and it's very relevant to me, not just because I'm a health nut and enjoy these conversations, but if you look at what we did with Level and Amentra before that, very much helping industries do what they call digital transformation, which I think is everything that you just described. That's what the medical industry needs, is transform, use the data that you've got, use the delivery mechanisms, whether it's an app or it's the sensors or it's these tests or any kind of digital technology, the software that you talked about that tells you the size of any pigmented lesions. One piece of technology that I've been using that I'm curious if you have any thoughts, and I've been using this ring. It's called an Aura ring. It's all sorts of sensors. And one piece I'm really curious about, if you're familiar with it, there's a measure called heart rate variability.
Yeah.
they tell me that this is the number one measure for how you're going to feel that day. And I've got to be honest, every time, every morning when I wake up, I look at that. And if it's low, I know I'm going to have a bad day at the gym. If it's high, I know I'm going to have a good day. What is heart rate variability and how, how do you make that better?
So that's a great lead into a question that, you know, all of these wearable technologies and, you know, smart beds, smartphones, the iWatch looking for heart arrhythmias, et cetera, are really interesting. Let me answer your question. And then I don't want to forget something, which is to talk about the development of using medical technologies and big data mm-hmm. by medicine, because medicine is using that to treat illness. Mm-hmm. The large money pools and the large medical establishment is not using it to develop wellness.
Sure.
And that wellness is back here in cottage industry, like my practice. Mm-hmm. And so that's an interesting point I'd like to tease out. Now, heart rate variability. Again, that is, what's your brain doing when you're asleep? Mm-hmm. Are you dreaming? What is the depth of your sleep? How is your central nervous system interacting with the sympathetic and parasympathetic nerves of your body? What is your, you know, is your heart happy and bouncing all around with the dreams you're having? Or is it sitting there and you're hypoxic and your heart rate is kind of, it's a secondary thing that your entire body's paying attention to? So again, I'm not the biggest expert on heart rate variability. I have an Oura ring. I don't have it on. I have a whole drawer of toys and things that I'm constantly playing with. You might do this. I'll give you a tip for a guy to interview who's actually I think he's the chief of intellectual and business development for the Institute of Functional Medicine. I'm not exactly sure what his title is, but he is the toy king. So, but again, things like heart rate variability, sleep monitoring and watching for apnea and the depth and REM sleep, and the quality of your sleep, all these things I think are fantastic. And if they can be used for as fulcrums of behavioral change to make you aware of problems that you're having and address those problems and improve upon them, I think there are marvelous things. So
I agree. Thank you for that. There's so many questions I want to ask, but I also want to be mindful of your time. But for our listeners who might not be in driving distance of Richmond, what can they do if they're getting shitty answers from their doctors? Is there a resource to find doctors like you? Or you've mentioned a couple books that they can use to educate themselves, but are there other concrete resources that they should know about?
I'm asked this question all the time. I'm going to answer it the same way I do. Drive to Richmond.
I do it once a year, sometimes okay. twice. So.
So there are, you know, there's individuals that I know, and I don't want to name their names, but mm-hmm. you know, there's a guy I know in San Francisco. He charges $70,000 a year as a concierge doctor. Mm-hmm. What's he got? A cell phone and a stethoscope. Now, he sells himself and he's good.
Gotcha.
Okay. There's a group in Indianapolis that I admire. But many times when we talk about, you know, I have people who ask me for referrals, you know, I'm going to move to Florida. I'm going to leave your practice. What should I do? Well, you know, what I'll usually say is, if I know someone there that I respect, I'll tell them to knock on their door. I just find many, many concierge or membership medical practices, again, are promoting the access to their practice, but many of them are not promoting, again, the delivery of personalized health care and wellness.
So maybe what someone could do is they could talk, because when our mutual friend Matt Ernst introduced me to you, and and because I told him I'm really struggling with these answers that my doctor gave me. I know it's wrong, but I can't exactly articulate why. Yeah. I need to find a doctor. He said, why don't you reach out to Dr. Baggison? And I, even though I knew Matt and a couple of other mutual friends that we have that are patients of yours, I still asked a couple questions. And for me, it was like, hey, I got an NMR panel. Can you talk to me about that and just get your overall philosophy? And it became very clear to me that prevention was what you wanted. I mean, I'm guessing that a couple concrete things that you've talked about here, they could ask doctors for their opinions as they're vetting a doctor.
Sure, sure.
In their own area. And
sure. So, you know, what would I do if I were looking at this and trying to find prevention? You've mentioned the book. Mm-hmm. Get them to read the Bale Dineen book, Beat the Heart Attack Gene, or Dead Executives Don't Get a Bonus. Mm-hmm. Become aware that medical care is not the same. It's not. And people, when they go look at a BMW or new Audi, they crawl up and down that car. When you're buying a new cell phone or it's picking a cell service, you're picking out every little part of that. People hear, oh, I'm going to join this medical practice. I'm just going to go join it. Well, what do they do? How do they do it? So
make it an active process, not just passively engaged.
That's correct. And I will admit that this is a frustrating topic to me, mm-hmm. because the promotion of this practice is a very difficult one. Mm-hmm. So from a business model, I used to advertise on the radio, and you know, a local radio personality came in here and I respect him and like him. And I tried to describe, you know, how you have to articulate this to the public. Okay. Who have an understanding of healthcare. And nobody understands that they have this need of preventative healthcare. So you have to knock on someone's door and say to them, you have this need. You don't even know you have it. You need preventative precision healthcare. And they're like, well, I go to the doctor. I get it. No, you don't.
Yeah.
But they believe they do. And to, you know, so now I'm turning Republicans into Democrats, atheists into churchgoers. And it's hard. It's hard. So, you know, the Bale Dineen organization has a list of doctors who are certified in that practice of the Bale Dineen method. And I use the Bale Dineen method as a core competency within this organization. But we use a lot of, you know, I want to take the best of a whole bunch of things and weave them into the very best program that, again, I, as a patient, would want delivered to me, knowing what I know as the doctor. I hope that makes sense. So a really tricky question for me to answer. And frankly, you know, people go, well, I'm not going to Richmond. I have patients in Korea, Canada, the United Kingdom, Belgium, South America, Mexico. You know, I've had two or three people come here from China.
Wow.
And I just don't know where else to send them. Now, there's another organization that I've mentioned that I think the synergies, I haven't mentioned them, but I'd like to, but the synergies of our programs, I think if woven together will be, and I've had the benefit of, you know, I've gone to the Cleveland Clinic when they were considering getting into concierge medicine and met with them. This is part of the American Academy of Private Physicians. I visited other physicians' offices and met with them. It's fun to do so because many of these people are the vanguard of doing this and are working outside the practice model. You know, when I go down to the doctor's lounge here in the hospital, people look at me and go, what in the hell do you do? And people pay you for this? You know, we run a service business. It happens to deliver medical care. That's what we do here. It's not a medical practice. So.
Gotcha.
Hope that makes sense.
It does. That's great. And you talk about all of these customers coming from everywhere. What are their scalability challenges? Because obviously you're one person who can only have so many hours in the day. I guess it's probably equally difficult to convince other doctors that your way is the right way on the supply side.
Brother, you ain't kidding. You're not kidding. So, you know, again, from a scalability standpoint, convinced. So I am a family physician. I'm a primary care physician. That's where quote unquote preventative health care goes on. Well, who goes into primary care in medical school? The people who want to save the world. The people who are entrepreneurs go into ophthalmology, dermatology, and orthopedics. Okay? They want to make money. What do family doctors want to do? They want to save everybody. So many of them are very altruistic. So finding individuals who have a holistic preventative care resume, which is family physicians, internists, many of them are there trying to be part of the system, and to step outside of it is foreign to their thinking. That's one thing. Females, female doctors, scalability. So right now, down at VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University, the School of Pharmacy is, I think, 60, 68% female. The average female pharmacist, I'm told, works for about 3.5 years. The average male pharmacist works for 34 years. Wow. Okay. So again, in our world where people want a job share and have job flexibility, my job, like many CEOs of companies, is 24/7, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, period. Mm-hmm. I've done it for close to 20 years. There's no other way to do that. John, if you pay me my fee, you don't want to talk to a nurse practitioner, my nurse, some intermediary. You want to talk to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to solve this. And it's I call it the vitamin I problem. So individuals here at this practice, you know, it's important and imperative. You know, we have plenty of corporate arrangements. We will share those patient volumes between ourselves. Mm-hmm. But many of us develop our own patient population. And just like a financial advisor, an insurance salesman, you know, your book of business is what defines you. And I'm not saying for a moment that I would suggest that people do this. You know, I'm a believer in recurring revenue, make money while you sleep. I'm not living it. I'm on piecework. I'm Lucy Ricardo on the chocolate line. I've made a terrible mistake, but I love what I do. Mm-hmm. And I think that if here we continue to advance our deliverable, I think that our footprint is soon going to transform from Richmond primarily, and exposure to a practice like this is word of mouth. So the patients that I have are frequently organizations that are based here, who have people who are, you know, come back to their home base, get this as a benefit within the organization, and then yet somehow learn of us. You know, I have a patient who has been an international celebrity business consultant, and I won't, that's all I should say, who learned about us because he consults with a business here, and the CEO said, oh, you ought to go there, and he did, and it's quite funny. But
I wonder if the investments you're making in technology, and as you see kind of this tipping point of big data and AI, I wonder if that helps some of the scalability, because people do need to see you, but maybe not for a full 2 hours out of the 4 hour process. Maybe you can drive that down over time through your continued investment in the technology.
You know, I think yes, but you know, we want to get to know our patients, you know.
Sure.
50% of why people go to the doctors are emotional issues. And to avoid stress, anxiety, depression, those are only things that come from a face-to-face contact, the establishment of trust and goodwill. And that just takes time. So this is a uniquely high-touch mm-hmm. endeavor. It is. We don't please everybody every time, unfortunately, and that just happens, like any other endeavor in life.
Sure, so. That's a big challenge. maybe you could speak to another dynamic within the industry, and I'm paraphrasing, and I've heard this from a lot of people, but it seems like there's an inappropriate relationship, or at least a perception of an inappropriate relationship, between most doctors and big pharmaceutical sales reps really pushing pills. I mean, is that a dynamic that works against you as well? Because that's obviously a source of revenue, and a lot of what you're doing is preventing the problem so that you don't need to be writing nearly as many prescriptions.
In this practice, it's not an issue whatsoever. Mm-hmm. You know, we still have a drug rep once in a while who'll bring us lunch. And frankly, I don't usually want to talk to them. They're not going to deliver, you know, they are bringing pharmaceuticals to treat the end stages of disease. In our practice, we have patients who have chronic medical problems. Mm-hmm. We write plenty of medications. Yet, you know, I'm going to use the medical letter or other third party. It's like the PBS of drug studies. That's where I get my information. Mm-hmm. This, I think, is kind of a common misperception. Nobody brings me golfing. Nobody brings me sure. to dinner. No one's sending me to Mexico on a junket. That's all. I don't know when the hell that happened. I wish I was there. I missed it all. So the influence of big pharma on me is zero, yeah. Completely zero. The influence of high-end laboratory testing, which is a constant friction point because it's expensive. It's a technology in itself. Mm-hmm. It's essential for wellness evaluation. Again, people don't understand it. And that might, you know, let's talk about health insurance for a quick second.
That was going to be my next question, is okay, how broken is that relationship?
So look, health insurance. People go, I got insurance. I go to the doctor. It's paid for, right? Well, let's compare health insurance to car insurance. And I'm talking about health insurance 5-10 years ago, because it is drastically changing with high deductible plans. But preventative healthcare. What do people get paid for if they go to their doctor for quote unquote a checkup? A lipid panel, a blood count, a urinalysis. Well, what does that tell us? You know, maybe something if there's a major problem. But I've already highlighted how useless the Framingham model is, in my opinion, to the real diagnosis of vascular disease. So that's what insurance will pay for. Well, insurance will frequently not pay for the studies, the laboratory studies that I've tried to describe today. So people have to pay out of pocket for that. So what you're getting for your healthcare insurance preventative exam is useless. And that's what they'll pay for. So if you bring your car to the gas station, you don't pull out your auto insurance card and slide it into the gas pump to buy gas. You don't buy tires with car insurance. You don't use your homeowner's insurance for a new roof or to cut your grass. These are preventative costs that you pay for out of pocket, and you get what you pay for. So health insurance is there, and it should be there for catastrophic issue, just like car insurance. You run into a telephone pole, you hurt somebody, you total your car, your insurance reimburses you. Health insurance, you break your leg, you have an appendicitis, you need surgery, you have catastrophic insurance. Other consumable products like preventative healthcare are out of pocket costs, mm-hmm. and you get what you pay for. And with the advent of high deductible health plans, like literally today, I have a patient, he's 46, his friend had colon cancer. He wants a colonoscopy. He has an $8,000 deductible. If I tell the gastroenterologist that he has blood in his stool and there's a reason, his insurance will pay for it. Now, he's got an $8,000 deductible. No matter what, he's going to pay for the first $8,000 of healthcare costs. Mm-hmm. If he were 50, his insurance would actually pay for it. So no one will pay for it now. Nobody will. If he had a headache and I wanted to get an MRI on his head and I used his insurance and sent him to the hospital, he's going to have about a $7,500 bill. Well, I have a contract with an imaging center. I can get his head scanned for $500. He won't use his insurance at all. So there are lots of ways to buy things in the healthcare field that can be done on a cash basis. Most doctors, most healthcare delivery organizations don't do it. They don't get it. But it's starting to catch fire. More consumerism in healthcare.
Yeah, no, it definitely, that's a very good analogy for sure. I like that one. And it seems like too often the debate in America, at least, is about who's paying. I don't care who's paying the insurance. If you're covering the wrong things and you're feeding people crap food and you're giving them this food pyramid that's completely broken and just giving bad advice in general, it's going to be too expensive no matter if the government pays it or an employee fund or an employer funded insurance plan or an employee funded one. I think we argue about the wrong things in health insurance, and it's interesting that it's treated so differently from other forms of insurance. We talked about a lot of the things that I wanted to follow here or talk about here. I didn't cover a lot of other things, but again, I want to be sensitive to your time. But I do want to end on a question just to get your speculation. And you touched on it a little bit. But for people who follow good diet and exercise and stress management, don't have some genetic time bomb that they just can't overcome with all of these other good environmental influences. What do you think a realistic expectation for a healthy and happy lifespan is? I don't personally want to spend any money on the last 2 months of my life. I want to, I care more about the happy lifespan than necessary, healthy and happy lifespan than just how long I actually live. What do you think is a realistic expectation now and maybe over the next 10, 20 years or when you see that real change talked about before?
Well, again, what kills us today is vascular disease. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, it can be prevented. And you've opened me up Pandora's box because there is an entity, which I probably should not name, but I'm going to give you a hint. There's an organization that has now developed what I will describe as a process of cholesterol dialysis. Okay. And this is counterintuitive to what we've been speaking about all this afternoon. But the organization has developed a way to take the recycling lipoproteins out of your body. So that's your HDL primarily. 98, 99% of your HDL is full of cholesterol and actually could promote, if those particles lodge in the wall of your artery, a problem. Mm-hmm. Well, this company has taken a way to take those out of your body and pull out cholesterol from those recycling particles. Mm-hmm. When that happens, those recycling particles express a very specific receptor, a receptor that now attaches to areas in your body where an inflammatory process is going on because cholesterol contained in lipoprotein particles has initiated an inflammatory cascade. These particles specifically bind to those areas, decrease the cholesterol content of those lipoproteins, and in so doing, stop the inflammatory cascade. Mm-hmm. It's the reversal of vascular disease. And to me, just like I spoke about the discovery by Fleming of penicillin, Pasteur of smallpox and measles vaccines, this is the next large step for the extension of human life. I think it will have impact on cognitive impairment, multi-infarct, small vessel disease, dementia, heart disease, stroke, and I think it's the cure to vascular disease. It's awaiting FDA approval as we speak. Wow. So what will that do? We're going to go from a healthy 80, 90-year-old, if you're lucky and have good genes, and follow, don't smoke, don't drink too much, sleep, manage your diet well, detoxify yourself, to probably another 10 or 20 years. And that's a guess.
Wow.
That's my own completely personal view of the world. And it's very exciting. It's very exciting. So
that is. Well, Dr. Baggison, thank you so much. I can tell already from the amount of ground that we covered that I think I'm going to get a lot of good feedback from folks, and I hopefully you can touch a few people's lives the way that you have mine, because it's been a real life changer for me. So thank you for that, and thank you for joining me today.
John, thank you for the opportunity. It's been fun.
All right, take care. Cheers.
Peace out, baby.
Yep.